Hallo, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, wir melden uns kurz aus der Zukunft.
Seit Folge 270 heißt dieser Podcast Geschichten aus der Geschichte. Mehr dazu findet ihr unter geschichte.fm.
Und jetzt geht's zurück in die Vergangenheit. Viel Spaß.
Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte. Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte, dann werden Sie sehen, Herr Reporter, wie das sich damals entwickelt hat.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Zeitsprung, Geschichten aus der Geschichte. My name is Richard, and usually that'd be Daniel saying his name right now, but Daniel is not here because today I have a very special guest, and this very special guest is Dr. Emma Southern.
And thank you for saying my name correctly as well.
Am I?
So few people do.
what is a common mispronunciation?
People pronounce it Southon.
All right. Yeah. No, I don't know. I think I did my research early on.
That was good research. Thank you. Right.
Perfect. Right. So, Dr. Emma Southern. I researched you a bit the way, you know, someone does research on the internet. So I went to your website and I found out, that you have a PhD in ancient history, from the University of Birmingham.
Yeah.
You taught ancient and medieval history for a while until you were fed up with the grimness of academia.
Yep.
Okay. So, yep. So now you're an independent historian or independent researcher.
Yeah.
And you write books.
And I write books, yeah. So I left academia and then I taught writing for a couple of years. I taught academic writing. Okay. And then I quit that and I was a freelance writer for a while. And now I sell books during the day and write books at night.
Well, that is a good way of doing it. I mean,
yeah,
better than the other way around.
It is,
You wouldn't want to have to sell books at night. Even though it probably would be quite nice to write during the day, right?
It would be quite nice, but I'm a night owl, so it works out for me.
So
when I was a freelance writer, I just slept all day and wrote all night, so this works out better.
So now you're even earning money as well.
Yeah, I know. It's a real privilege.
So the reason why you're on this special episode is because of a book you wrote. And the book you wrote is Agrippina, Empress, Exile, Hustler, Whore. And it's a very catchy title already.
It is a very catchy title. Everywhere else has taken that bit of the title off. So in England, it got published with that title. And then it's not got that title in America.
Well, go figure.
Unsurprisingly.
Unsurprising.
But it sounds so good.
It does. And I don't want to spoil the book for anyone here. We're probably going to spoil it because we're going to be talking about Agrippina quite a bit. But I do want to spoil, the fact that it's a very good book.
Thank you.
I read it and there's this phrase people use when they say something is eminently readable.
Yes, that is a phrase I know. Yeah,
and it's not just eminently readable; it's a fun read as well. How should I put it? If this is the way you teach people to write academically, I only in the future want to read books written by your students.
Yeah. If I took anything away from me, it should be that it should be. I think the things if you want someone to learn from. Or take anything away from what you've written, then they should enjoy reading it. It shouldn't feel like they're being lectured. So I tried to make it feel like it was a nice... The aim was that you would feel like you were sitting with me in a pub and we were having a nice chat about Agrippina. And I was having a kind of conversation with you rather than that I was standing in a lecture theatre lecturing you for hours with boring slides. So,
well, I think you quite succeeded there. The interesting thing is, and maybe we might touch upon that later on as well. But it's not just a conversation, sort of a conversation in the book. It's academic as well. I mean, you cite your sources, right?
Absolutely. It's got got good rigorous history. Yeah.
Right.
I sneak the history in right. And hopefully people don't notice too much. So it's in there and quite a lot of it is really like analysis of the sources because they're so difficult and they're so there's huge gaps in the sources where that you have to work around when you're writing a biography of somebody. So, you know, when you look at how much of the book is telling a story and how much of it is analysing sources, quite a lot of it is me talking about the sources. But I've kind of tried to do it in such a way that it doesn't feel like it either undermines the story and it isn't boring. That's the main thing I wanted. I wanted it to not be boring and to be like, most of history, like when you're a historian, mostly what you do is look at the sources and analyze them and think really hard about them and look at them from loads of different directions. And so that's the fun bit. Like that's the bit that gets historians up in the morning to read some more sources and enjoy them. And I kind of wanted that bit to be fun as well as the bits where people are kicking their way into rooms and shouting at emperors, which is also very fun.
Of course.
but I think that history is just, I mean, I love it. I have tried to quit being a historian 3 times now. And I have attempted to do other careers. And every time I have just ended up coming back because I love it so much and nothing else makes me want to get up in the morning and keep doing it. And I love it enough that I have a proper job, like that I go to 9 to 5 and then I come home and I sit and do more history because I just think it's great. And I wanted in my books, I want people to feel how much I love it.
Absolutely. Well, I think judging from your book, you're really good at it too. So it'd be a shame if you quit it, you know.
That does help.
No, but coming back to what you said about the sources and discussing the sources in the book, and I'm kind of derailing my own concept that I've written down here for this episode because we're already talking about the sources. But, you know, honestly, it's a really interesting bit to me as well because oftentimes you read a historical book and there's actually no talk of the sources at all. Mm. So everything is presented as, you know, as fact, but we all know that, or like people that have studied history, they know that most of this is interpretation. A lot of it is conjecture. Yeah. And then there's no discussion of the sources and the way you do it and the way I like to do it when we talk about sources in the podcast as well, is just to show people how, first of all, what the job of a historian is, that you actually have to analyze the sources and sort of make up your mind whether a source is trustworthy or whether it's not trustworthy and why certain things are written down and why certain things are not written down. And I think that you have done very well in the book. And I think it's sort of one of the cornerstones of the whole telling of the story of Agrippina, it's basically a problem you have with the sources and you have to deal with it. And
it is.
And you have to
and
be.
She,
yeah.
Yeah. She is a very interesting person in that when you're looking at the sources, because she dominates certain sections of the sources. So particularly Tacitus is history and the annals and later Dio's Roman history, like she just dominates these sections and there seems to be so much about her, but then big chunks of her life are just completely absent. And there are entire decades or we don't really know, no idea what she was doing. And because she is only useful to the source writers at certain times. And so then they write about her a lot. And we know, well, we hope we know loads about kind of 5-year periods of her life where she seems to be really fascinating to the sources. And then all of a sudden she's not for 5-year periods. and so it is, she's a really interesting person when you're thinking about why people in the Roman world wrote down what they did and what they want, what kind of messages they were trying to portray and to send with their writing, and to be able to see that they were not writing regardless of how much Tacitus tries to say that he's writing, he's just writing objective facts. And he claims that he's just writing the things that happened in a row. But it's when you look at how he shows Agrippina, you can see where he is picking and choosing what he wants to say happened in any given year, and is in making his decisions about how he wants to portray a particular year in Roman history, depending on whether he wants it to be a good year, in which case there's no Agrippina, or a bad year, in which case there's loads of Agrippina.
Of course. Exactly. And I think this is a good moment where we can sort of segue into the into who Agrippina actually was.
Yeah.
Because we're already talking about her, as if everyone knows who Agrippina is. Maybe before we sort of go into the details of why she actually is that well known and why she wants that special kind of person, maybe you could sort of give a short description of who that woman is, who she was, and what makes her so special as compared to other famous Roman women, for example.
Okay, so technically her name is Julia Agrippina, but she's known often as Agrippina the Younger, because in a way that the Romans love, her mother was also called Agrippina, and her mother was also quite a prominent woman. She was the daughter of Agrippina the Elder and a guy called Germanicus, who were the kind of young, sexy prince and princess of Rome during the reign of Tiberius, who is the second Roman emperor. And Agrippina the Elder is the granddaughter of Augustus, the divine Augustus by this point. So, and pretty much all of her brothers and sisters have been killed or died under somewhat mysterious circumstances or have dropped dead of disease. So she is pretty much the last one standing by the time Tiberius comes to power. And so she is the last blood descendant of Augustus. And Germanicus is the son of here's the son of Antonia Minor. So he is the grandson of Mark Antony. And he is adopted by Tiberius and is like the second in line to the throne, basically. But he is, between them, they are immensely popular. They are just absolutely like the Beatles in Rome. Like, people run out in the street and mob them wherever they go. They're just young and gorgeous, and they have six children. And he's a great general. He has loads of victories in Germany, which is a big deal because under Augustus there was a great defeat in the German forests, which made the Romans hate the Germans forever. made Augustus very sad. They lost three legions under a guy called Quintilius Varus, and which is one of my favourite anecdotes about Augustus, actually, which is that he was so sad that for 3 months he stopped shaving and cutting his hair and took up banging his head against walls, shouting, "Quintilius Varus, give me back my legions." Those Germans were led by a defector who was a Roman, and so they were a real problem. And finally, Germanicus beat them. So he got revenge on the German tribes. And so he is considered to be this great Roman hero as a result. And he has six children, three boys, three girls, of which Agrippina is the oldest girl, who was born while he was in Germany, actually, in what is now, I'm going to say it in German, right? Köln.
Right.
He has the six children, and then they all come back to Rome. And then Germanicus mysteriously dies while on holiday in Syria. And everybody thinks he's been poisoned by Tiberius, cause a lot of problems. I'm going to fast forward through a solid decade.
Right, sure.
So a solid decade later, after Agrippina is brought up by her mother alone and alongside her brothers and sisters, she her mother and older brothers, two oldest brothers, are killed by Tiberius under circumstances that we don't know because that bit of Tacitus is missing. And the only brother left standing is Caligula, who a little bit after that becomes the emperor. And she gets to be the sister of the emperor, which is pretty good.
And I think, you wrote in your book that we actually shouldn't call him Caligula because it's, you know, he had a name, right?
He did have a name. His name was Gaius.
And it's sort of disrespect to give him, to call him by the name they called the little kid at the in the army camp.
Yeah. Because Caligula is a like diminutive version of Caligo, which is what the Roman like army sandal is. So he was like calling him bootykins, basically, or little boots. And people would call him it after he became a bad emperor because they didn't like him. And so they would do it in order to mock him. And I have an absolutely irrational soft spot for Caligula. There is absolutely no good reason for why I like him so much, but I'm really defensive of him and I always will try to defend him. calling him Gaius is a lot of, you know, just makes him sound like a person as well. I think when you call him Caligula, he becomes this like semi-fictional monster.
Right.
And I actually wrote my undergraduate dissertation on modern representations of Caligula.
Okay.
And there's so many, like he's in comic books, he's in all of these films, he's in all of these cartoons and things where Caligula is a fictional monster who's so evil that he's not even human. And I think that makes, when you say Caligula, people imagine something that is so ludicrous that they lose sight of the fact that he was a person. I tend to call him Gaius.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think that is actually something that I've noticed when I read your book, that you always try to sort of convey that, you know, the people that we're reading about or the people that you're writing about, they're actual people, you know. it's not just these templates or these ideas that we have when we think about, you know, about Rome and about the people that live there, that they're actually people, and a lot of the things they do, it's just what people do because they're people.
Yeah, and people are inconsistent and do odd things that you can't explain. And you just need to look at any kind of politics and be like, I have no idea why this person is doing this. Not to get too political, but just look at what's happening at the moment in this country. Like, you're just like, what is happening here? Why? Right. None of this seems rational. Like, people are odd and they were all doing things for their own weirdo reasons. And sometimes they just do things really rashly. And sometimes they do things and go, oh, I don't even know why I did that. And I think that quite a lot of history, particularly ones that try to tell big narratives, try to act like people are always very rational and and are doing things for very rational reasons. And I don't think that that's particularly true. I think people are probably mostly just trying to get to the next day without fucking anything up too badly.
And I mean, that is especially true for Rome at that time, you know, because you mentioned it a couple of times that what a bad idea it is to give someone the power over an empire who's 17 years old, for example.
Yeah.
So exactly. Why would you do that?
It's ludicrous. And the only reason they do it is because he has the right blood, basically. Gaius is like 27 when he gets the empire, but he is basically a child because he has been hidden away on Capri and has never met anybody really. And then Nero is 17 when he becomes the emperor and is like, I've met 17 year olds. So I wouldn't. We don't let them vote.
Right. You probably wouldn't trust them with your car, so you certainly wouldn't trust them with an empire.
Exactly. You trust them with an entire... And then all of a sudden they're expected to do loads of paperwork and know how to do all of the diplomacy that they need to do and do wars and do all of the other stuff. And unsurprisingly, Nero gives up on all of that immediately and just goes into singing. But...
Right. But let's just... Well,
before we get there.
I think we jumped a bit. And we don't have to do this in too much detail, just so we can, you know, keep the timeline, right?
Yeah.
Because so, currently she's the sister of Caligula, who's now the emperor, right?
Yes. And he is very good to his sisters and he gives them loads of honors and he thinks they're brilliant. And in return, they plot against him. Plot to kill him with some troops in Germany, which he discovers very early on into the plot. And there's this great scene where he turns up at their holiday home in a place called Melvania and uncovers the plot. And presumably there's some kind of terrible showdown that ends with Gaius reading out Agrippina's love letters. And there's a trial. And because he does like his sisters quite a lot, he doesn't execute them. He exiles them. Mm-hmm. So she gets exiled to quite a nice island, actually, called Pontia. And she spends a year in exile. And during that year, there is a more successful coup against him, mm-hmm. Involving his uncle Claudius and the army, So Roman emperors have a kind of personal army in Rome, which is called the Praetorian Guard,
right.
Who are very, very important because they answer only to the emperor. They don't answer to the Senate, and they belong to the emperor, and they are like a couple of thousand armed men who live in the city of Rome who live to protect the emperor.
Right.
And so when they turn against the emperor, things right. tend to go quite badly.
And it's happened quite a bit, hasn't it? I mean, not at this time when I think it was Gaius on the throne, but afterwards you had a couple of emperors that were sort of dethroned by the Praetorian Guard, right?
Yeah, by the time you get to the 3rd century, you get a lot. Right. Happens every 2 years or so. But this is kind of the first time that they overthrow an emperor. Mm-hmm. And they install Claudius on the throne. Claudius is Germanicus's older brother. But he has been considered the embarrassing member of the family because he has some kind of physical disability and he is also very boring. So he has been kind of shuffled off and he's never been shown in public really, and he's been hidden away and he's been writing massive books about the history of the Etruscans and inventing new letters while everybody right. else has been doing politics and war. And then all of a sudden he becomes the emperor. And very kindly, he brings back Agrippina from mm-hmm. exile and gives her a nice husband and tries to keep her happy but quiet. So she goes from being sister of the emperor to the exile to coming back and being a kind of upper class but not particularly prominent woman. So she has access to the emperor because yeah. he's her uncle, but she's not exactly like in a circle.
Right. And at this point, that's actually her second marriage, right?
It is her second husband. She's married at 13 to a man in his 30s, obviously. And then she had her one and only son, who we remember as Nero, but was born Lucius Domitius Henobarbus. And she had him in the first year of Caligula's reign. So he is kind of about 3 or 4 by the time she gets back from exile. She is separated from him and her husband dies while she is in exile. Mm-hmm. So she gets back, she gets her kid back, she gets like mediocre husband and everything seems to be okay. Until Claudius's wife does something, and this is one of the reasons why I say that people are weird. And like she decides while Claudius is on a day trip to marry someone else in the middle of Rome.
As
the Empress of Rome in a city which is very public. You know, she has a wedding ceremony and marries a guy. And even the bit of Tacitus when he's describing it is just like, he just can't believe that it happened. he is just baffled by the fact that it happened. And it is utterly baffling.
Yeah.
And fairly obviously, this ends up in her being executed because you can't have that kind of thing, which leaves Claudius wifeless. And something happens that is super weird and mysterious, and there's no real good explanation for it. And suddenly, Claudius gets the law changed, the incest law changed, and marries his niece. He marries Agrippina.
Right.
And there is this very ludicrous scene where somebody else suggests in the Senate that maybe they should change the incest law so that Claudius can marry his niece, as if it was a big surprise present for Claudius.
Right. And she and he acted surprised because that was his job, right? Deposit the idea, and he's then going to act like everyone just wants him to marry his niece.
Yeah. Basically, it's just a great mysterious surprise for him that everybody in Rome agrees that it's a great idea for him to do this very convenient and beneficial marriage because he gets a kind of an almost adult heir. By the time this happens, Nero is about 13, 14 years old. So he gets one who can, that's as far as the Roman aristocracy are concerned, that's an adult. He gets to marry Agrippina, and she is enormously popular. Everybody thinks she's great because of her dad, mostly. She gets this reflected glory from her dad that Claudius never gets from being his brother. And so he gets her glory. And prior to marrying her, his reign has not been going well. There's been a couple of attempts to overthrow him. There's been a really big attempted coup with some troops trying to rise against him. He has executed quite a lot of people because that's really the only thing he knows how to do. It's going very badly indeed. And so he kind of needs some good things, especially after the Messalina debacle where she marries someone else, which just looks bad when your wife marries someone else while they're still married to you.
It's not a good look, really.
It's not. It's embarrassing. No one wants to have to go out and tell their friends that that's what's happened to them. Is it like embarrassing enough when you've got a breakup anyway and you have to go and tell everybody that you broke up without having to, like, he literally married someone else.
Well, it's so interesting because we talked earlier about how people, make decisions and you don't know why they made them because they're so blatantly stupid, for example.
Yeah.
and I think when you talked about Messalina, his wife, marrying this other guy, that you simply think that, because this historians try to, explain it, find
they
an
do,
explanation
yeah.
for this, for, rather irrational behavior. And you said in the book that in your mind, she probably just wasn't that smart.
Yeah, no, I don't think she was very smart, bless her. I think that she just didn't really think it through more than the fact that she wanted to do it. and that, it went badly for her. God knows what she thought was going to happen, but I think she just wasn't very clever.
Right.
She was very young. She was 17 when she married Claudius, and she was 21 when she became suddenly the wife of the emperor, and she's still in her mid-20s when she dies, and she's had two kids. She is, she's young and an idiot.
Probably. I mean, that is sort of the misconception, people have when they read about people from the past. They think everyone, was a super villain.
Yeah.
super intelligent or everything simply because, people wrote about them. But there's idiots nowadays. So why shouldn't they have been idiots back then?
Doing idiotic things, And I'm pretty sure that Messalina was just kind of, bless her, just kind of an idiot who did idiotic things. I have I feel slightly defensive of her as well, just because she was so young and I just think she didn't get much of a chance. and she was probably not very smart. She just seems to have done everything a bit wrong.
A couple of people in your book that did everything wrong.
There are a few people in who just seem to blunder from one bit to the other until eventually they fall on a sword. Yeah.
Right. So, so Messalina, Claudius' wife, Claudius' wife, she gets executed.
She does, along with 8 other men. Yeah. And.
Oh, right. No, we've been there already. I sort of jumped back again. We're already at Agrippina.
They're already married. Right. Yeah. So how Tacitus presents the fact that he marries his niece is that there is this kind of philosophical round table between Claudius and his closest advisors, who are all ex-slaves. And each of the advisors has a candidate for marriage. So they're all trying to put forward their best candidate. Mm-hmm. And one of whom is Claudius's first wife. One of whom is a woman called Lollia Paulina, who is remembered because she is just very pretty. And she married Caligula briefly, but he divorced her because it turns out she didn't have anything more really than being very pretty. So they offer up all these other women, and then one of them offers up Agrippina and says, basically, we know that she's fertile, she's got a good bloodline, we know that you get on, she will be good for the dynasty, she'll be good for your popularity, and if you're lucky, she might have babies, which is super gross. And basically the argument that they make is that if the most honourable marriage you can make is with a member of the imperial family, then the emperor should only marry a member of the imperial family, because he should only marry the most honourable woman.
Right.
So that's their brilliant argument. Obviously, it is a kind of, it's a set piece that he writes that this happened. Maybe it is indicative of kind of palace workings, kind of, you know, palace machinations, but that's his theory. But that makes Agrippina a kind of passive object in that she had nothing to do with it. Suetonius, who is a biographer, says that she seduced him by sitting on his lap and kissing his cheek, which is a way of making her basically into a whore, and making Claudius into somebody who's too dumb to do anything. As soon as there's a woman in front of him, he just has to marry her, regardless of what's going on. Possibly it was somewhere in the middle. Possibly it was something completely different. Possibly he decided that he wanted to marry her and she, as a woman, had no legal power and had no ability to say no, which I think is something that is often forgotten when we're talking about this stuff. Like, she has, even if she didn't want to marry her uncle, she had absolutely no ability to say no. It would have been a marry him or probably die. But they got married on New Year's Day. And then she was married to her 50-year-old uncle, her third husband. And then Tacitus writes about this as if an earthquake hit Rome that day and everything after was picking up after the earthquake.
Right.
Because he thinks that she immediately becomes powerful. And Tacitus hates that.
Well, it shouldn't happen in Rome, right? To have a powerful woman like that.
It absolutely should not happen in Rome. Everything is set up specifically to prevent that. But also everything in their system was very carefully set up after they threw the kings out to prevent one person from having lots of power. And they've now got a monarchy. So things go wrong every so often.
And I think it's interesting that that Agrippina, already back when she was just Caligula's sister or Guy's sister, she already had more, sort of not more power, but she had more freedom than a woman usually had, because he, you know, invested her with the Vestal Virgin privileges, right?
Yes, he did. So
she was kind of used to, not having to live strictly in that system.
She was released from a lot of the legal kind of constraints that were put on women, and she was also given a lot of power, like Romans had lictors, which is were people who would walk beside people who were, I say people, men who were in the Roman government. So if you were a Roman magistrate, you had an official job, then you got a lictor or two lictors, if you were very important, who would walk in front of you and they would carry the fasces, so the bundle of sticks with an axe in it, which represented the power of the state and the ability of the state to kill you.
Right.
And they, which is where we get the word fascism. And he, and so the more you had, the better you were. By the time you get to them having emperors, an emperor would have about 12. So it was a procession of lictors walking down the street. And so she was given a lictor, where under Gaius, and she was given the ability to ride in a special cart and got the best seats at the games and things like that. And also the ability to sign contracts without being, without having a man do it for you, which is probably even more important.
Right. One thing I'm not quite clear about, because when she was just Gaius' sister, she had these privileges, right? Then she was exiled, and when she came back, did she still have those privileges, or were they gone?
No, they would have been gone.
Okay.
So all of that was kind of stripped from her, and she got them back when she became Agrippina Augusta. So in the first year of Claudius's reign, first year of her marriage to Claudius, she got made into, she got given the title of Augusta, which is the feminine version of Augustus, which by that time had become like basically the title of emperor. So when you became emperor, you took the name Augustus. Mm-hmm. And she is the first young woman to, and the first kind of, the first woman is still involved in public life to take that title. And then she gets all of that stuff back. And that makes her, that's what kind of the point at which she becomes really special and really important in the Roman world.
And she effectively becomes the Empress of Rome.
Yeah, that's the point at which she becomes the first kind of proper empress. So there are two women before her who get given that title. One of whom is Livia, Augustus's wife, but after he dies, when she is quite elderly, and she is basically still confined to a domestic space by Tiberius. Mm-hmm. And the other is Antonia Minor, when she is very old indeed and practically bedridden. So she doesn't get to exercise it very much. Whereas Agrippina is in her 30s and she is granted this title and she immediately becomes the emperor's partner. And that is the first time that a woman has become a partner in rule. Every previous woman has kind of confined themselves, for better or for worse, to the proper domestic sphere of womanly influence. And Agrippina shows up receiving diplomatic missions and appearing, sitting on a throne next to Claudius, and becomes a part of his advisory council, and absolutely scandalizes everybody as a result, because a woman has never done that before, and a woman is not supposed to do that. And they, the Romans, literally think that women are incapable of doing that. So they don't like it one bit.
Well, they've never actually, you know, had someone do it, so they wouldn't even know if they could do it.
No.
But they just assume it's impossible because, you know, obviously they're not men. So
as far as they're concerned, every woman who ever has any kind of power becomes, immediately shows her kind of feminine nature and becomes cruel and despotic and tyrannical. And they have, if you asked a Roman, they would give you infinite examples of this happening. And most of them would be women ruling households full of slaves, but they consider that to be the like proper place for women. And even then they think they can't do it particularly well.
And I think that you mentioned that in the book as well, that what Agrippina does is she sort of, she sort of tries to be masculine in her demeanor. So she doesn't, you know, flaunt her femininity. But rather sort of, you know, tries to mimic the way that, you know, men would behave, which of course then they kind of said, you know, that that's not right either. Because
It's a lose-lose situation, because if she had dressed in pretty dresses and been and worn lots of jewels and been feminine, then she would have been criticized for spending too much money on jewels and being feminine and luxurious. But because she is quite austere, and she's notorious for being kind of quite being anti-luxurious, right. She doesn't wear lots of jewels. She doesn't wear big embroidered tunics. She wears kind of fairly basic clothing, and she has no real interest in big dinner parties and luxury and spending lots of money. And she's not very, doesn't decorate herself like women are supposed to decorate themselves. That therefore she is considered to be freakishly masculine and kind of disgusting that way instead. Right. So she is a bad woman if she does womanly things, and she's a bad woman if she does masculine things. So she couldn't win whatever she did. So she just does her thing. One point she does try to mix the two together, and she turns up in a very spectacular event wearing a masculine Greek military cloak made of gold thread, in order to really annoy everybody by wearing man's clothing, but man's clothing made of gold.
Right.
But that's because she's kind of great. And I love that kind of the fact that she would occasionally, she just has no fear at all. And I find that amazing. She does things that would, that no other woman I think would try to do, no other person would really try to do, because they know how much opprobrium they would get for it. And the first time that she appears beside Claudius, she is, she's receiving a British prisoner who has been causing problems in Britain mm-hmm. for a long time, called Caratacus, and they finally capture him and bring him to Rome, and he is paraded through the streets and then brought to Claudius, and sitting in next to Claudius on her own throne in front of the kind of big standards and the flags of Rome and the army is Agrippina. And it's just such a shocking thing for them to see, and it's such a really powerful moment, and it must have been a kind of a shock for the people as she kind of came out and sat down. It must have been quite the ripple of excitement going through the through the crowd, and it really is something that people talked about for a long time afterwards, because she was really putting herself in a public space and sitting next to her husband and saying, I am the Augusta, he is the Augustus, we come as a team.
And I mean, that was probably sort of the outward way of showing what had been happening sort of inside the palace as well, when, you know, the clients came to talk to the emperor, and then there was suddenly the empress as well, and basically doing the emperor's job.
Yeah, sitting next to him, hearing out, doing the deals that you do in the day, like most of a Roman person's, and well, an elite Roman person's day is taken up with like the round of meetings that you have in the morning with your clients and patrons. And when you're the emperor, you just have a lot of clients who rely on you for their careers and who come and see you every morning, and you have to talk to them all every single day. And it's a kind of big ritual part of the Roman day. And she would all of a sudden have been there in like receiving all of Claudius's clients as her own mm-hmm. and being, and then they would go off and discuss matters of the empire with his advisors, who were all men, and the head of the Praetorian Guard and all of the other politicians and consuls and senators who were close to Claudius would be there. And then there would be this woman in the middle of it for the first time in history.
Right.
just being the first person to ever do that and causing absolute shock, because it was just beyond anything that they could really imagine that a woman would try to do this. The politics is coded in the Roman world as an inherently masculine space. It's like her walking into the men's toilet and using a urinal. Like, that is how they, it's just such a masculine thing that they cannot comprehend properly a woman doing it.
Right. So what would you say, what is the reason why it works for Agrippina? I mean, what were the things that she did? Or, I mean, was it the fact that Claudius was, you know, kind of, you know, feeble or weak?
It is the fact that Claudius lets her, Like, it is a monarchy in the end. Roman monarchy is a very strange monarchy in that it is a kind of, it's balanced on two legs, one, the army and the Senate, both of whom have to be kept happy all the time, but it is still a monarchy. And Claudius is still the only person who gets a say it really in what happens day to day. And as long as Claudius lets her be there and Claudius doesn't say anything, no one is going to say, what the hell is she doing here? Because Claudius can have them executed at any minute.
I mean, it's not unheard of.
He quite likes doing that. They're all quite afraid of him. And also, it helps that she's really good at keeping people happy. Like, when you burrow down into what was happening after she came into power alongside Claudius, you see that she very carefully balances keeping every, giving everybody something so that nobody is unhappy at any time. So when she needs to make changes, everybody gets something and nobody gets nothing. So there is no reason for people to resent her. She doesn't destroy people's careers. She might shift their career around a little bit, but she doesn't like have them thrown in the Tiber or exiled, which she could have done, but doesn't. And so she is very good at making friends. And when you look at the, at things like how many people are executed or exiled during Claudius's reign, you see that almost all of them happen before Agrippina comes into power. And there are no attempts against Claudius's life that don't come from Agrippina. In after she becomes, after she becomes empress, like the coups and attempted assassinations just drop off. And she is involved clearly in arranging some quite difficult situations. So there's a big situation in Jerusalem, which could be really difficult, that because she is involved in it ends up being managed without kicking off into a war, which it does almost a few years later under Nero. And she's just really good at diplomacy. And obviously Tacitus describes all of these as really terrible things because she's involved in them. But when you kind of take a step back from how he's describing it and look at what he's describing, you see that she's doing really good work. And so people have, apart from the fact that she's a woman, people don't have too much of a reason to hate her.
And I mean, that's so interesting that you said that Tacitus is the one who's, you know, describing how terrible it is that she has that sort of power, but doesn't even realize that he's, you know, describing sort of a stabilizing force in the whole empire, and, you know, responsible for the fact that Claudius wasn't, you know, killed even earlier than he was.
I don't think he necessarily thinks it's a good thing that Claudius wasn't killed earlier, because he's not a mad fan of Claudius. If he had had his way, then the entire Julio-Claudian family would have been thrown in a volcano very early.
Well, just in the sense that, you know, as a spectator or an observer, you don't root for anyone to be killed. Generally.
No. He is, and that is what he describes. He thinks he's describing the absolute degradation of Rome. Like the worst that it gets is under Agrippina, and then Agrippina is responsible for Nero. So, and Nero is universally considered to be bad. He has really not that, he has zero friends in Rome ever. So Agrippina is the very bottom of how bad it can get in Rome as far as Tacitus is concerned. But what he is describing is a pretty stable, very good, strong reign where she does lots of good things, where she's founding colonies, where she is keeping the edge of the empire happy. She keeps the center of Rome happy. There's no real disasters or famines or anything during her reign. And he describes a really good five-year period of rule.
Speaking of founding colonies, for the benefit of our German listeners,
yeah,
you mentioned it before, where she was born, which is interesting because it's basically, you know, the name you said is the name derived from the colony that she founded.
Yeah. Right.
So could you maybe just say a few things about that?
So she was born on the edge of the Rhine in what was it was a kind of Roman camp. So it was originally the home of a people called the Ubi. And then the Romans were friends with them. So it became a kind of Roman camp and she was born there. It was a base for when Germanicus was moving into Germany. And then when she became empress, she decided to found a city there, found a colony. And a Roman mm-hmm. colony is where they would settle Roman soldiers. So everybody there became a Roman citizen. And then the person who founded it would become a kind of patron of the city and they would look after it and it would get lots of investment. And it was called Colonia Claudia Ara Agrippinensium, which gradually got, it became a very big center of Roman activity there. It became a really big center for glass manufacture, really big place where a lot of artisanal glass came from and a lot of the glass that was used by the Roman Empire. It became a really big space for Roman culture mm-hmm. in that part of the world. And gradually that name got shortened to Colonia, just the colony. And gradually that became Coln, what we call Cologne in English. But it is her space. And a couple of years ago in 2015, which is the 2000 years from Agrippina's birth, they did have a big kind of celebration of her in the museum there, and they were she's better known in Köln than she is probably anywhere else in the world, because they have a big parade every year, and they have the mother of Köln, Agrippina, is like this character that gets to be in it, and she's kind of kind of pantomime tart.
Okay.
But it's something. But yeah, so it's so she's the founder of the city. And she does that much better than Claudius ever managed to do, because she doesn't kick anybody out, whereas Claudius founds a couple of places in Britain. But every time he does it, he removes everybody who's there and then gives all of their land to some Roman soldiers. And then you end up with things like the Revolt of Boudicca. Which happens quite like just before this, really. And then Agrippina does it very successfully and it becomes a massive center of activity. She does everything well.
So the people of Cologne are basically the ones, or should be thankful to Agrippina for the fact that they're cultured like that, because they were sort of, you know, that their city was born out of Roman culture and glassmaking and all that.
Absolutely. They wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Agrippina.
So. Right.
I mean, somebody else might have founded a city there, but it exists as it exists because of her. So, and I went there, actually. I made my partner go on a holiday there. And it's a lovely city.
Yeah.
Great cathedral, lovely museum, highly recommend it for a visit.
Right. And I think they have quite good beer as well.
They do have very good beer. Yeah. And they do that little, that thing, which I think they only really do there, where they give you like a quarter pint and then they just keep coming around and giving you new ones. And before you know it, you've drunk about five and you can't stand up.
That's convenient.
It is. but it tastes very nice.
Right. So she was a very good influence on the empire, basically, or on Claudius and then the empire. And then things go south.
Things go a bit south, yes, when she kills Claudius, which is a real problem.
Things go a bit south.
They do go a bit south. There's like a whole debate, and I have a debate with myself back and forth constantly as to whether she did kill Claudius. And in the end, I came to the conclusion that every single source says that she did, including the very tiny number of contemporary sources, like people that lived and worked alongside Agrippina said that that is what happened. So quite possibly, I think it's like I have to lean into the fact that she probably did actually kill him.
Yeah.
And quite possibly it's because the thing that is the most important to her is getting Nero to be emperor. That is the kind of defining goal of her life, really, which is not so much because she doesn't want to rule by herself and she never really tries to rule by herself. She wants Nero to be emperor. But Claudius had a biological son of his own. And for a long time, it was fine because Nero was kind of 6 years older than Britannicus and his mother was around. So he kind of he was given like proper jobs as a judge and things when he was about 14 years old, which is very silly, and was made like prefect of the city of Rome, which is, I just keep thinking of all these people who had to deal with him on an official basis and just looking at this 14-year spotty teenager. And he's supposed to be making important judgments about crimes going on in the city. But as Britannicus grows up and starts to hit like adulthood himself, or adulthood in the Roman sense, and starts coming kind of up to 13, 14 years old, he becomes a threat, basically. And it's possible that Nero won't become emperor. Possibly Claudius will want his son to take on maybe a joint emperor role, or he'll want him to be emperor instead of Nero. And so as that starts to happen, Claudius mysteriously dies after eating a mushroom that may or may not have been poisoned by Agrippina and a woman called Locusta, who is a notorious and very famous poisoner. And then I think that Agrippina expects everything will be all uphill from there, because she kind of arranges it all very carefully so that Nero, who is 17, comes out and is hailed as emperor immediately. She has been in charge of his education. She has given him these two tutors called Seneca and Burrus. Burrus is the head of the Praetorian Guard, and he is like the head of the army, so he's on side. Seneca is this famous philosopher who I irrationally hate.
Well, he's not a very grateful person, is he? I mean,
he's not a very grateful
person.
He's
been brought back from exile twice, I think, by Agrippina.
Yeah,
and he's still being a shit to her.
He's a real shit to her, and he's given the job as being the advisor to the emperor, and he's kind of given everything by her, and he is kind of notorious. It's kind of a joke that he is this famous Stoic philosopher who failed to live up to any of his Stoic principles. So he writes loads and loads about mercy and about being austere and about not having, like, not reacting badly to things. And yet Dio, for some reason, really hates him, which I find really funny. And he writes all these passages about how he owned 150 tables. And he writes about being modest and austere, but owns all of these tables and spends all of this money on himself while chastising everybody else for for spending too much money. So he'll complain about other people's luxury while living in a luxurious palace of his own. And the only time he ever manages to live up to his own ideals is as soon as it comes to the idea of a woman in power, at which point he undermines his patron Agrippina at every turn. As soon as Nero becomes emperor, Seneca writes this speech for Nero, in which he says that the first thing that's going to change in the Roman Empire is that there's going to be no more interference from the imperial household in politics. Right. So there'll be no more freedmen and slaves and women involved in politics, basically, which is a direct blow and saying no more girls. And then there is this moment that happens, which is like this great turning point in Agrippina's career, where in the first year of Nero's reign, he is receiving a delegation of people from Armenia, mm-hmm. who are kind of this buffer zone between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire. And both sides always want to control it because they want this buffer zone against the others. So Armenians are always turning up. And there looks like there might be a war against Parthia in Armenia, and everybody's very on edge, and everybody's very concerned that there's going to be a child led by a woman leading this war. And the delegation comes and they're all prepared, and Nero comes in and sits down, and then Agrippina comes in and goes to step up onto the dais to take her seat. And Seneca whispers in Nero's ear, and Nero has this kind of split second decision as to whether he is going to let his mother sit down and receive this delegation with him.
Right.
Or whether he is going to prevent her from being there, and whether he's going to be a partner with his mother and let her continue her role, or whether he's going to side with what Seneca is telling him to do and remove her. And he chooses Seneca, and he stands up and greets his mother and gives her a hug, and then carefully leads her away and takes her out of the room, and basically says to her with that action, "You are no longer a partner in this, ruling this empire. You are my mother, and you will be in a motherly role, and I am the emperor, and this is man's business." And then in order to make it up for her, in the final kind of spit in the eye, he buys her a pretty dress and basically says to her, you are ornamental. Your role is ornamental, to be domestic and pretty and stand over there, and I will do, me and Seneca over here will do the business, which she kind of takes, as you would, quite badly.
Yeah. I mean, it's either he doesn't know his mother, or he really wants to piss her off.
Or he knows exactly how to hurt her. Like, it is either that dress, when he buys her the dress, I just think either he is like a rubbish husband who just brings home like flowers from the corner shop to say sorry for something, and just doesn't even think or try. He just thinks, what do women like? Pretty things, I'll just give her that. And he just doesn't know. Or it isn't. It's an insult. It's just such a deliberate insult to her. And the fact that their relationship goes downhill quite quickly, and she is later evicted from the imperial house. So she is sent to live in another house, and she is banned from receiving male visitors. So people aren't allowed to go and talk to her anymore. And she is kind of ostracized within Rome. And then there is a moment where she comes very, very close to being either exiled or executed, because her ex-sister-in-law kind of drums up this very weird conspiracy while Nero is drunk, and nearly gets him to execute Agrippina in the middle of the night for allegedly conspiring against him, but is stopped by Burrus, actually, who is pretty loyal to Agrippina all the way through, to be fair to him. And there's this great moment where Burrus basically says, "Look, you're drunk, calm down. we'll sort it out in the morning, go and sleep it off, and we'll talk to your mum in the morning and we'll see what happens, and we'll just let her have her say. So Nero goes and sleeps off, and the next morning Boris goes and sees Agrippina and tells her what's going on, and she demands a meeting with her son, and there's this kind of behind closed doors chat which no one knows what happens. But by the time she goes in, on the verge, he has, you know, the last thing he said is that he wants her dead, and by the time she comes out, she is back in the palace.
Right.
Some of her friends have got new jobs. Like, one of her best friends suddenly becomes the prefect of Egypt. And the people who accused her are all exiled. So she has talked her way out of being executed and back into his good books, which is brilliant.
Well, she was probably like, listen, you little shit.
Yeah. Look, what the fuck do you think you're doing? At that point, Tacitus has nothing more to say about her for 5 years. Huh. She vanishes, just completely vanishes.
So she vanishes from the source material. Yeah. But she doesn't vanish from Rome.
No, she's still in Rome. She's still pretty. Like, all of this is speculation because there's nothing written down as to what she's doing, nothing stated as to what she's doing, but she is almost certainly around and still involved in politics and doing kind of behind-the-scenes political things. So she is no longer doing spectacular things like appearing in a big cloak made of gold in front of massive audiences, or receiving delegations and things which make people talk. She is doing more behind-the-scenes things and involved in Nero's reign. And the reason that I'm pretty confident in saying that is, one, the first 5 years of Nero's reign are pretty good. He doesn't do anything too terrible or fuck anything up too badly, despite being effectively incompetent. And two, because after that 5 years, he decides to kill her. And if she is happily sitting in a villa somewhere outside of Rome or chilling somewhere, not involved in politics and not doing anything at all, then there is no reason for him to kill her.
Right.
And the general reason which is given for his decision is that she is constantly trying to be involved in his life, and that he wants to marry a woman called Poppaea, but he already has a wife called Octavia, who is also his stepsister, obviously. So he has this wife who's a very quiet, seemingly quite nice girl, who Agrippina is great friends with, and there is no situation where Agrippina will let him divorce Octavia. Octavia is really popular. She is a great, you know, wife of the emperor. She never does anything to cause trouble. She is just good at getting on with stuff. She's like a proper good little Kate Middleton kind of girl. Like, she's just really well behaved.
Right.
And there's no way that Agrippina is going to let him divorce her without breaking his knees, and like it would just end badly. But he really, really, really wants to marry Poppaea, and he really dislikes Octavia. And the best thing that he can think of as a way to deal with this, because he is the emperor and he can, is to just kill his mother.
Right.
So, but if she is not a big enough force that, in Rome and in Roman politics, that he can't get away with doing stuff as the emperor without killing her, like that's the only way that he can get around it, then that suggests that she's still really important. The other thing, of course, is that he initially tries to get Burrus to just stab her, because that's what like the easiest way to kill somebody in Rome when you're the emperor, is just be like, can you go and stab her, please? And Burrus says that no soldier will kill her because they like her too much, that no soldier is ever going to kill the daughter of Germanicus. So she still has this immense popularity, and it's just not going to happen. So he has to come up with some bizarre series of events to try and kill her without making it look like he killed her.
Do you want to go into the detail of the foiled plot on the in the boats? Or
yeah, he has. Yeah, there's a few different plots which get put together in different sources. So there's one plot which involves him poisoning her, which seems very sensible, but it turns out that she takes antidotes, so poisons don't work, so she is taking antidotes. And then there is a bizarre plot which Suetonius says, which makes little to no sense, which is that he's going to rig the ceiling of her bedroom so that it collapses on her while she's sleeping. And that gets foiled because nobody in her household will turn against her. So right. She has a loyal household, so nobody will let the workmen in.
I got to install a new air conditioning.
Yeah, exactly. So though that fails. So this guy who is in charge of the Navy has seen some kind of like games with a trick boat, and he thinks this is a great idea. So he comes to Nero and says, look, there's this trick boat that we can use, and it's really unclear how it works, but it either kind of collapses or opens in some way or kind of dips or something, and the people on one side are thrown off. And then it kind of goes back together again. So it's a kind of showboat of some kind that makes little sense. And Nero, because he's very theatrical as a man, thinks that's a great idea. So he gets Agrippina to come and visit him for a festival, and they have a nice dinner. And then he gets Agrippina to this dinner, and they go have a nice dinner, and then he takes her down to the dock and puts her on this boat. And this kind of shows the ludicrous richness of the imperial the imperial throne, which is that they get boats from each other's houses. They're so far apart that they just get a boat from each other's house back home again. Puts her on this boat, and Tacitus has this very nice picture that he paints of this calm night and her lazing on this boat and them kind of floating under the stars. And then all of a sudden the boat collapses. She is tossed into the water. But in a demonstration of how poorly Nero knows his mother, he doesn't know that she is a very strong swimmer,
right.
And is able to, without much problem and with an injured arm, swim happily to the shore. Her maidservant her slave gets off slightly less well because by shouting, "Help me, help me, I'm Agrippina," and gets beaten to death with an oar.
Right.
But Agrippina is smarter than that. She gets happily over to the stone. She walks back to her house, and she sends a messenger to Nero's house to say, "Wouldn't you know, there's been an accident." What a mysterious thing that has happened. And then she waits for the response, because I think she can't believe that it has really been a plot against her. Like, she hopes that it has been an accident, because she just sits and waits. And what Nero sends back is he sends back troops. He sends a whole lot of troops with knives, and he sets up this weird thing where he throws a dagger at the feet of the messenger that Agrippina sent and says, "Oh my goodness, Agrippina sent someone to kill me. Better send someone off to kill her." And these troops come in and drag out her slaves and stab her to death in her bedroom. And her last words, according to Tacitus, are telling them really to stab her in her womb, because that is where she is. That's where Nero came from. So, and that she is immediately cremated by her household, by her slaves and freedmen in the garden. And then her ashes are buried by the side of the road. And that,
no big funeral.
No big funeral. She never got to be interred in the mausoleum of Augustus, where the rest of her family were. She never got to be mourned properly. And in fact, because Nero told everybody that it was a plot against her, that he kind of forced everybody to give thanks for her death instead of mourning her, and kind of prevented people from mourning her at all. So she was, for the, really the rest of his reign, she was, he still occasionally celebrated her birthday, which is very odd, but she was kind of forcibly forgotten. Mm-hmm. Which is not, I think, what she would have wanted or expected in any way. I think that when she was at the top of the Roman world, the idea that she would be buried and lost and not forgotten, but would not have, you know, golden statues of her paraded through the streets and a huge wailing funeral would never have really occurred to her, but that's what happened.
Well, at least she's on a float once a year.
She is on a float once a year. I feel like that would probably make her happy.
I mean, on the other hand, when you look at her and what she aspired to while she was alive, that she sort of had this kind of power that no woman had before her. It's probably she cares less about being dead and more or less forgotten than she'd have cared about not having had that power when she lived.
Right? Yeah.
So it's in the end, she probably was all right with having the power. And when she's dead, well, she's dead.
Right? Yeah. And in the end, she got the thing that she wanted the most, which is that her son was the emperor.
Right.
And it got back into the Julian side of the family and away from the Claudian side of the family. Admittedly, he did end the entire lineage by being so bad at it, but she couldn't have predicted that. but her final achievement was that Nero got to be emperor, which he never would have without her. So,
yeah, I think the thoughts of a mother wanting to sort of doing everything that her offspring is. It, you know, sort of becomes either emperor or king. I think, and usually these kinds of women are the ones that are sort of reviled by the historiographers, right?
So yes.
It's like you shouldn't have ambition when you're a woman.
Absolutely not. Even if that ambition is for your children,
right?
That you are still being involved in an area that only men are supposed to be in, and
right.
You are therefore inherently doing something that you shouldn't be doing. So you should just immediately stop.
Right.
And any woman that does it has to be punished in the history books and has to be reviled in order to show any future woman what will happen to them if they try it. And then, you know, and there are no women really after Agrippina who tried to do what she did for a very long time, for like 150 years, until like the Severan dynasty. You don't, no other woman tries to do what she did or tries to be as prominent and as actively powerful as she was. So it kind of works, like the remembering her as this terrible villain and remembering writing about her as though she is this failure in every way, as this degraded representative of everything that can go wrong, works in preventing other women from being able to do what she did.
I mean, the historians or the historiographers, they do that with men as well.
Yeah.
But I think that the way they do it with women is, it's like a more backhanded kind of thing, you know what I mean? We actually did I did an episode on this Bohemian queen or empress, actually, from the 15th century, Barbara of Sili. And she was Holy Roman Empress, and she was known as the Black Queen mainly because they said that she was like an alchemist, which was not that bad, but at least... But also that she did all these occult things and, you know, was actually a vampire.
Amazing.
And I mean, she was, you know, she was very involved with all kinds of church stuff. So it's not like she, it was probable that she was a vampire. But these were all the things that were sort of attributed to her because she was in a feud with Albert II of Habsburg fame. So,
and he, the Habsburgs won,
right. And so this is, you need to find just one who sort of plants, you know, rumors or sort of this negative connotation of the name, and then it sort of, through the centuries, it'll just get picked up and sort of embellished, and then you have what you have with Agrippina or Barbara of Sillé.
Yeah, and that people are so willing to believe it as well is the thing. It is, because the story of the monstrous woman is such an easily believable story to men who hate women, that it is so pleasing for people to continually tell the story. And that's obviously a great story that they said she was a vampire. That's brilliant. That's the kind of story that I would tell. Like, you would totally repeat that if somebody said it to you about a politician. If somebody said to you, the Queen of England is a vampire, you'd be like, amazing. Which is why, yeah, exactly. Why I talk so much at the beginning of the book about the story that that David Cameron fucked a pig, which was a big deal here, which is, as I say, like, not true, didn't happen. Yeah. He did not have sex with a pig. But it's such a good story, and it fits so well what people who don't like David Cameron think of David Cameron, that he is like this big, stupid Tory who will do anything in order to be liked. And that he's massively posh and goes to parties where they have pigs' heads on the table. That it kind of doesn't matter whether it happened or not. It's too good a story not to tell. And that's stuck to him forever. And in like 100 years' time, 200 years' time, when people write biographies about David Cameron, they'll have to include it.
Sure.
You can't not write about it and not write about Piggate.
You know, I think it's probably more flattering for him to be remembered as the man who fucked a pig than the man who fucked Britain with Brexit. Right?
That's going to be the chapter titles, though. Like, David Cameron fucked a pig, David Cameron fucked Britain. And like, those are going to have to be the sections in his biography forever and ever.
Sure.
And that kind of... I'd say that sucks for him, but fuck him. But that is, you know, and you get the same kind of story forever and ever for Barbara of Sillé. You're just going to have to say, oh yeah, and people said she was a vampire. Because it doesn't matter whether it was true or not. It's stuck to her now because it's too good a story and it worked too well with what people wanted to think about her. And people are so happy to believe stories like that about any woman in power. Like, oh yeah, she just slept away there.
And an interesting connection between her and the story of Agrippina actually is that in the sources, Barbara of Sillé is called a German Messalina.
Yeah.
So they sort of directly compared it, even though she never killed anyone.
Never married anyone while she was married to someone else.
Right.
Yeah.
She was just a woman. I mean, she was quite powerful. I mean, she had her own court. Basically did what her husband did when it came to, you know, the work that that a queen or a king does. But, you know, she just had too much power. So all these things were kind of invented about her.
And this is kind of what happens to women. Men who do power badly get tarred. So Nero does power badly. He doesn't do it right. So he gets remembered as a villain. But other men do power well and they get, like, you know, Trajan. Everybody loves Trajan. Everybody loves Marcus Aurelius. But a woman being in power, it just gets reviled for being a woman with power. She can't do it right and she can't do it wrong because she's trapped in the bind of being a woman in power. So she's already buggered.
Yeah, she shouldn't even have tried.
Yeah.
Why'd she even try?
Just sheer fearlessness. You know, it went all right for her for a while. And it usually does go, you know, they're remembered badly and quite often they have to deal with all the nonsense, but they still get to be in power. So.
Well, the good thing about Agrippina is that, you know, finally in the year 2018, she got, you know, your book.
She did. So, finally.
I think everything's all right again with the world of Agrippina.
Yeah.
Because we can actually look at it in a way where we're not just influenced by whatever Tacitus decided to write about her, but sort of, interpret the things that were written about her or the things that were not written about her.
Yeah.
And I think, we touched on that briefly in the beginning. When it comes to the sources, the really interesting thing, I think, is that what you mentioned as well, that, or not as well, what you mentioned, that's why I know it, that she just appears when she's there in connection with another man.
Yeah.
And when she does something that whoever writes about her, doesn't really like.
Yeah, when she does something that impacts a man, then yeah, she is there and being remembered, and usually she's, because she's impacting a man, she's being annoying. And then when she's doing stuff that doesn't directly impact in a dramatic way a man next to her, then she's just vanishes completely.
Yeah.
Because the sources are only written, which is why my book had to really have the structure that it has, where she is, daughter, sister, niece, wife, mother, all of those are her relationship to other men. And she is all of those things, but she is also a person who is separate from those things. But that person who existed separate from being the niece, wife, mother, sister of emperors is invisible to us. We can only see her through those lenses of how those men impact her and how she impacts those men. Anything else that she ever did is vanished because it's not interesting to Tacitus.
Right. And I think that sort of leads us back to the beginning of our chat, which is already, I think, about an hour and a half long.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it to be that long, but it's just such a gripping story. So I think it wouldn't do it justice to just do it in half an hour. But I think we are at this point where we can say that telling the story of Agrippina in such a way, the way you did it, is just you doing your job as a historian.
Yeah.
And just, taking these sources and taking the absence of her in the sources and taking the way she's described in the sources as a consort or a mother or a daughter or a sister, and, interpreting it in a way that it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think you did it very well.
Thank you very much. I'm glad. I'm very, it still feels a bit weird to me that this book that I wrote in my, I wrote mostly actually in a caravan in Bundoran in Donegal in Ireland.
Okay.
In the middle of nowhere, which belongs to my partner's parents, because it has no internet out there.
All right.
And we would go down there, and so much of it was just written there in a haze, really, or in the middle of the night up in my tiny little spare bedroom. And there it is now. Like, the people who are actually reading it and enjoying it is just still feels very odd, but it's brilliant. I'm glad that people now know who Agrippina is. All I wanted really was for people to know who she was and to think that she was great, even if they don't particularly like her, because she's not very likable, just be impressed by her.
Well, I think the way you describe her, she's not necessarily unlikable. she's a complex person.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the takeaways of your telling of her story, that she's all kinds of things and
yes,
not just sort of a template. So thank you very much for coming on and taking that much time out of your,
thank you so much for having
your
me.
Busy evening, which you'd rather spend writing, I think.
Sorry that my cat decided that she wanted to also be on
no
the
problem.
Podcast.
No problem.
She was obviously jealous.
We're a cat-friendly podcast.
Yeah. She is called Olivia, so
all right.
She's Roman too.
Of course. She wanted part of that.
Yeah.
Speaking of writing, are you working on another book?
I am working on another book. It is about Roman murder.
So very different.
Very different. I decided that I wanted to do something completely different. I didn't want to write the same book twice. So I'm writing some Roman true crime now. Hopefully this week there's going to be like an official announcement from my publisher, which I'm waiting for. But
Perfect.
Yeah. But yeah, so that will be out in 2020.
So we're going to have you on again in 2020.
Yeah. Okay, you can look forward to that one in about a year. Yeah.
I hope lots of people will read your book now, even though you basically told the whole story.
I didn't put all the jokes. There's loads of jokes in there.
Right. So yeah, it's a very funny book. And yeah, there's lots of pop culture references in there. So yeah,
loads
if you're
more detail
on Twitter
about
or on Tumblr, you probably understand 90% of the jokes. Yeah.
There's a lot of Twitter jokes in there because I spend a lot of my time on Twitter.
Right. So. Well, it's I do too, and that's why I actually saw that you had written that book. Otherwise, I probably, you know, I saw it on Twitter historians and whatnot, and then I saw that book and I thought that is a very good story. And then I got it, I read it, and I thought you have to tell it on the podcast.
Well, I hope I've done it justice.
Absolutely. Thanks again, and have a good evening.
And you, thank you. I'm going to go and probably have a gin and tonic now. So.
Perfect. And I think the perfect ending to this bonus episode about Agrippina. Thanks again to Dr. Emma Southern for the chat. This was a bonus episode to episode 183, the regular German language episode. If you've never listened to our podcast, but you do understand German, do have a look. We have 182 other episodes already recorded. I will leave you as always with the one person who always gets the last word in this podcast, Bruno Kreisky.
Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte. Lernen ein bisschen Geschichte, dann werden Sie sehen, Herr Reporter, wie das sich damals entwickelt hat. Wie das sich damals entwickelt hat.